91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Today's program begins with a discussion of long-term care and the nutritional health of seniors. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. Good nutrition paves the way for good health and independence. We'll visit with healthcare and independent living advocate Josefina Carbonell and learn about innovative community-based senior care. She's a former Assistant Secretary for Aging at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. And more, both Miami-Dade and Broward Public School students head back to class Monday. And with Linda Gassenheimer, we hear about how school lunches and snacks keep up with good nutrition, flavor, and value. That's next, Topical Currents, after the news. And it is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. We begin today's program with discussion of community-based healthcare services and nutrition for senior citizens. The largest expenditure in the U.S. healthcare system is for nursing home care, Bonnie.
And obviously, by remaining independent, seniors lead more fruitful lives and avoid high expenditures. With us now is Josefina Carbonell, a longtime advocate for healthcare and seniors. She's a former Assistant Secretary for Aging in the George W. Bush administration and has served on commissions, boards, and committees on the subject.
She's an expert on Medicare and Medicaid, and now she's a Senior Vice President of Long-Term Care and Nutrition for the Independent Living Systems Company. Thanks for your time, Josefina Carbonell.
Thank you, Joseph and Bonnie. Really appreciate the opportunity to be with you and with your audience today about this very important subject matter.
Yes. You've been the recipient of many awards, and as we said, appointed by President George W. Bush in 2001. Tell us a little bit about your background and more about you and your work as a social services advocate.
Yes, well, I started down in Miami as a community provider. So we founded Little Havana Activities and Nutrition Centers with an original grant, seed grant, that came from the United Fund at that time. It was called United Fund at Bay County in 1972. And it was actually the first model project under the Older Americans Act programs across the country when they were testing those in 1960. You know, in the 60s, it was born at the same time that Medicare and Medicaid were born. And we were a model project for Hispanic communities. And so I worked my way through the community and through the organization, grew the organization, and then did a lot of, trying to promote independence, you know, trying to address the high-risk individuals, the people with a lot of chronic conditions, people that had not been tended to for some years, and obviously the senior centers, the meal sites, the home and community-based care services. And that work took me to some national boards, the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, an advocacy organization, and then both La Raza and National Alliance for Hispanic Health, to look at ways that we could take the messages of prevention and independence and choice to people across the country. So that brought me, I think, to the national stage, and I got noticed for some reason, and I was asked to serve. We were one of the largest nutrition and senior center organization in Miami-Dade County. And served in, obviously, state boards, the blueprint for long-term care under Governor Graham and Governor Childs, and then the creation of the Department of Elder Affairs in the state of Florida. And that took me, I guess they noticed me, and they asked me to serve on the transition team during the Clinton-Bush transition. And I actually was not looking for a job up there, but got drafted, got the incredible honor to be to serve as Assistant Secretary for Aging at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and actually served under two secretaries, Tommy Thompson, Governor Tommy Thompson from Wisconsin, who was known not only for his welfare reform activities, but also his activities in reforming and promoting independence and home and community-based services in his state of Wisconsin. And then I also had the pleasure and honor to serve alongside under Governor Mike Leavitt from Utah, and was excited to be the co-lead in the implementation of the Medicare Part D benefits and the preventive benefits that were launched. And it was a humongous task to make sure that 42 million people at that time were on the Medicare rolls, understood that there was a new benefit that they had a right to receive, and that benefits would be extended to different Medicare Advantage plans.
Did you say B or D?
Part D, the pharmacy benefits.
Okay.
Yes, that was started under our administration that now has continued to grow. Very proud to have led that effort, the outreach and education with about 49,000 events across the country in kitchen tables and city halls and community colleges and plain folks' homes across the country, talking to Medicare beneficiaries and talking to their families about the importance that they needed to sign up for this benefit. It wasn't automatic like they used to be with Part A and B,
right,
et cetera. So went across the country in the Medicare tour buses and that kind of stuff, and it was very exciting. Had the also the opportunity, obviously, Medicare was the big reform efforts during our time, just like Affordable Care Act is during this administration. But the second biggest thing that happened was the implementation of the ADA, and the most important thing was, the promotion of home and community-based services and Project Independence, and then the rebalancing of efforts to give people choices in long-term care to remain at home or to return home after a hospitalization or a brief, skilled facility care. So I had the great honor to serve along many of our aging providers across the country, and now I'm at what my son calls me, the Josefina 3.0 version. I'm in the private sector and doing exactly that. My lifelong passion of serving elderly and working with aging and community providers throughout the country, from home care to home and community-based care, and nursing homes and assisted living facilities, and being able to promote the rebalancing of the efforts that have taken place under the innovation that has afforded, to take place under the Affordable Care Act, particularly with states where, in many states, the Medicaid budget is the biggest expenditure is the long-term care services. And within the long-term care services, obviously, it's nursing home placement, yet people want to remain independent for as long as possible,
right,
and living in their own home. So that's what we do. We work with health plans and health care providers, both public and private, throughout the country, providing mostly managing and assisting manage high-risk populations, from pediatric patients to disabled IDD, NDD populations, all the way to elderly in long-term care.
So, Josefina, with your extended resume that we've just been reviewing and your long-term public service, particularly in the care of in the aspect of elder care, are there new wrinkles in Medicare for long-term care for older Americans that they should be aware of, or be aware of?
Right. Well, the important thing is that both Medicare and Medicaid and the Older Americans Act, the three programs, actually turned 50 years old just a few days back, the end of July. Those three pieces of legislation, those very important programs, all happened at once, and they had a purpose.
Could I interrupt you for a second to please explain what the Older Americans Act is?
The Older Americans Act is the largest piece of legislation that was enacted in 1965 at the same time that Medicare and Medicaid was. And it's a discretionary program. It's not a mandatory program like Medicare and Medicaid is. But it's a discretionary program that then promotes community living, promotes independence, promotes the choices of individuals to remain at home and to have the kinds of long-term services and supports that people need. But in general, nationally, I think the question that came from Joseph is, you know, what about long-term care services in the context of Medicare? Well, the reality is that people think that long-term care is covered under Medicare, and it isn't. Actually, there is no long-term care program in this country. There is long-term care services paid under Medicare, and that's after you you leave an acute facility, you're in a hospital, and you need extended care, wound care, or you've got a clinical issue that, you know, you can be released from the hospital, but there's a tertiary time that you're going to need supports of clinical nature.
Could that be something like post hip replacement or something like that?
Yeah, well,
for
right
a finite
now,
time.
Right, so you're nursing, you're going to rehab, like my father, who fractured his hip and then had the operation, and then went to a rehab facility for a period of time, and that was paid under Medicare. So it's the clinical side of long-term care, but it's only paid on an episodic basis. So there's no long-term care policy and no long-term care program. Medicaid was never created. Medicaid was created to be, you know, a health care program for the poor. And the bulk of the population covered is young people and families and children, you know, without insurance and low income. So it's an income-based entitlement program. But de facto, Medicaid has become the payer of long-term care. So it pays for 60% of the long-term care in this country, yet only 14% of the population is eligible for Medicaid, because you qualify for Medicaid because of your poverty level. So it's an income eligibility, and if you've got functional status, then, you know, you've got functional needs, and you have disabilities, then you become qualified. But, you know, it's still an income eligible, so it doesn't cover everyone.
Well, you cite a fact that the average Medicare patient is a female in her late 70s with a net worth of $30,000 to $45,000,
yes. Mm-hmm.
Whose largest asset is her home. So how does she, if she's not on Medicaid, how does she afford care at home?
Well, that's, you know, that's part of the work that we have started, you know, some years back, and that it continues, and that's what we're seeing, the innovation models happening in all the states where the federal government has given opportunities for states to innovate and to rebalance their long-term care services. It's the biggest expenditure in any given state is the Medicaid budget, and within that, it's nursing home. So people, you know, part of the issue was that nursing home is an entitlement, and if people qualify because of functional and clinical needs, and they're nursing home eligible, they are given the opportunity to, you know, it's an entitlement. They are entitled to receive care in a nursing home. Well, what began to happen is during our tenure and has continued to grow in this administration is states are grappling with their economic situations, their downturn, large numbers of people in Medicaid, multi-populations needing to be covered, and at the same time, people wanting to remain at home. So what has happened is what is called rebalancing, that each state has taken, when I got into the office, about 85% of the dollars spent in Medicaid were being spent for nursing home care. Right now, we're right at the tipping point of about 50%. So it has moved, the needle has moved to give people choices under the ADA implementation to choose home and to go back home if safely they can remain home and bring, you know, and be brought support services to remain. So the average individual woman, you know, in their 70s, with a retirement income of about $20,000. As a matter of fact, I think it's 60% of the Medicare beneficiaries in this country, and there's about 50 million at this point in time. they have incomes of $20,000 or less. Mm-hmm. So that's the majority of the people under Medicare are living in those kinds of situations. So very few people can afford long-term care insurance, although
right.
long-term care is available. And that's why there's now a lot of experimentation and a lot of financial incentives being created in states, and they're being very creative to make sure that people are offered the ability to come back home after, you know, hospitalization, hip fracture, and to make sure that there's supports there to provide those supports.
So
the Older Americans Act also provides some of the supports, but again, it's a discretionary program, and budgets are tight, and obviously, you know, that's very difficult. So I think that, you know, we're at that juncture right now where Medicare in general, obviously we're aging as a nation. We're the graying of America's here. It's happening much faster than, you know, in the European countries happened. It was a longer period to become old. We're becoming older much quicker with the baby boom generation. And we know that with advancing age, the needs of those older adults are really becoming much more complex. You know, people are living longer. You know, the advance of medicine and the supports and the access to health care that includes, you know, one of the most important programs to maintain health, both for elderly and disabled, the Medicare program.
So what, what's being done to innovate ways to have our elder citizens be better nutritionally
right.
cared for, to keep them out of nursing homes, or to help keep them out of nursing homes and assisted
right.
living?
Right.
What's
we
being
know
done
the,
to specifically help them?
Yeah, there's a lot of new preventive services that have been implemented under Medicare. That there are benefits that are in many instances, people are beneficiaries, and our seniors and families don't know about those benefits. And it's very important that they understand that it's not just a Part D benefit covered for the pharmacy, that, you know, there are numerous benefits that have been added on prevention. The importance of nutrition, particularly nutrition after an acute episode, the importance of making sure that the nutrition plays a very important role in the delivery of health care, particularly for chronic care patients, and the importance also of nutrition and medication. Now, how important that is. So traditional medical approaches and treatments that really have been have become so challenging, you know, has moved into, you know, individualized care that includes, you know, that you get a full assessment. So Medicare is requiring everybody under Medicare is required not only the entry level physical and your checkup as you enter a Medicare, but an annual physical, but also a whole array of medical and preventive services, including vaccination, smoking cessation, mental health support.
What about procedures?
Right.
Colonoscopies or?
Right. All the kind of preventive and screenings that have been included, colonoscopies, you know, breast exams. All the treatments to be able to detect, you know, illnesses earlier and to intervene. Even people with chronic conditions can be managed both clinically and in their communities much better. So now Medicare is turning to incorporating, along with the medical, the social approaches to health and, you know, and basing it in the community. So
what does that mean, the social approaches?
Yeah, well, the important thing is that people feel much better coming back home after feeling sick. And just being home in their environment, their surroundings, where they know, you know, the neighborhood, they know their houses, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
So the thing is the intervention of social support. So, for instance, there is Medicare is investing in ensuring that when you are entering a hospital, there's, you know, about 50% of the Medicare beneficiaries that enter a hospital are at risk of readmissions and avoidable readmissions, because when they go home, right, they don't have the right supports. For instance, they don't have nutrition, proper nutrition. They come home. We provide under the nutrition services in many of the health plans the ability for those people to have the right kind of food for their chronic condition. So let's say they have an acquired, you know, now they have got to have a heart condition. Now they have become diabetic or they have multiple comorbidities.
Right.
The importance of being able to coordinate care at home and to be able to identify those services and identify that that person going home after hospital, if they don't have the right supports or they don't eat the right food or if they don't take their medication, if they don't do their follow-up visit with the physicians, the most likely that it, and have and lack transportation and you know and have some functional limitations, that person will be back in the hospital. So now Medicare is paying for transitional care, and that means that people have access to those kinds of benefits within their Medicare and their health, you know, and their Medigap policies and their, you know, their Medicare Advantage policy. So it's very important that now that open enrollment comes, it's coming now, it opens October, when does that open? October 15th, it's a shorter period, it's earlier. So it's important for all the Medicare beneficiaries to be aware that this is a very important year for them to look at their benefits. It's not just if they're satisfied with their benefits, that's fine. The benefits change, the makeup of the benefits change. It's not just the pharmacy. It's their physicians, it's their healthcare condition. So it's important that they shop wisely.
Can they get coaching for that?
Yes, absolutely. Part of the efforts are there's several opportunities. Obviously, the you know the Medicare.gov websites, the 1-800-Medicare that people can call, and there's a whole education and public information out in the field. There's also a program that's funded under Medicare together with the Older American Act programs, and it's available in every area agency on aging across the country, including right here in South Florida, the area agencies. You have the what they call the SHIPS. In Florida, we call them a SHINE program.
We've had them actually on the program, the
right.
SHINE program, yes.
Right. So this is a pitch for them. First, kudos, because they are the ones that are across the country can do face-to-face and can help families and their and the beneficiaries navigate through their choices. And it's important because it's not just the prescription drug. People think it's the prescription drug, and actually my doctor says, oh, I'm part of the network. So now it has advanced tremendously. Even the Medicare Advantage has grown tremendously across the country, and it's because the programs are being much more broadly run. Their networks of providers or of primary care physicians as well as specialists is much broader. And therefore, you know, there's a lot of physicians and specialists that are in these health plans, and people save money. People save money out of pocket in these kinds of plans, and that is becoming a preference. But it's important that you shop around for the right benefits, and it's important that you understand that it's not just your physician, it's making sure that if you're happy, you ask the right questions in this open enrollment.
So in the next few months, anyone who's on Medicare now needs to completely reevaluate their program?
Absolutely. Okay. Every year, just like when we're working and that every year there's open enrollment and we choose cafeteria style. Well, the important thing is that seniors have a lot of very good choices. And it's very important to be able to look at beyond just the medication, you know, the Part D benefits. It's important to look at the medication because sometimes they change in tiers and coverage, and then there's out-of-pocket expenses. And because there's been pressures on the Medicare providers to be more streamlined, become much more efficient, they're paying for performance. There's a lot of more transparency in population health. That means that plans are required to really assess the patients comprehensively, not just for their medical needs, but comprehensively. Are they living alone? Do they have a caregiver? Have these people fallen? You know, in the last 6 months,
right.
Have they been hospitalized? Do they lack transportation? So it's a much more comprehensive view at the patient, and it's patient-centric.
Oh, Safina, before we go, I just, you know, for some reason I've always thought, oh, being at home is certainly preferable to being in a nursing home or an assisted living facility. But all of a sudden, when I was preparing for the program, I started thinking to myself, what about there? Is a nursing home ever better? What about for the social interaction and the stimulation, whereas you're isolated often when you're at
right.
home, or your regulation of medicines and compliance with doctors' offer,
right.
you know, orders or medical attention, better
yes.
and more
nursing
regulated?
Nursing homes and institutional-based care, you need, you know, it's not that we're replacing it. It is that there has to be much more broader choices available
right.
along the continuum of care as you age, you know, and that people... Even in facilities, number one, we're doing much better in screening these facilities and licensing these facilities and monitoring these facilities. There's much more openness in making sure that families shop right, you know, and absolutely those choices have to be there. 24-hour skilled care might be the only choice for an individual.
I'm sorry, we're...
No, that's
just about out of
yeah,
time.
Yeah, just about out of time.
Uh-huh.
But it's been a pleasure. Josefina Carbonell is the Senior Vice President of Long-Term Care and Nutrition at the Independent Living Systems Company. She's been a social services advocate for 30 years, the recipient of many awards, and she was appointed by President George W. Bush in 2001 as the Assistant Secretary for Aging at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. And if anyone wants to contact you, Josefina, do you have contact information?
Yes, they can contact us. It's 1-888-262-1292. 1-888-262-1292.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Josefina Carbonell.
Thank you very much, Bonnie and Joseph. Thank you for this opportunity. And remember, open enrollment is coming up. It's important for you to really review
okay.
your benefits and choose the right one.
Okay, great.
Food
thank
and dining you. Up next. Thank you. And we're back, 34 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's topical occurrence. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman on this Thursday. Welcome now to our Food and Dining Thursday with chef, author, and syndicated columnist Linda Gastenheimer. Well, it's August the 24th, so it'll be back to school any day now. And Bonnie... I bet you were the kind of student who loved going back to school, as opposed to me, who detested the thought. I bet you were the teacher's pet, and you got straight A's and all that.
Wouldn't you talk to my parents?
I can just see it. Yeah, I can see it.
Well, yes, August 24th, it's Miami-Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach. They're going back to school. Yes,
well, it's the 26th, but today's the 24th.
Today's the 20th.
And they go to school on the 24th.
A fountain of misinformation here.
We can see how well you did at school.
Right.
Yes, yes. That's why he dreaded that first day.
Exactly. Well, you know, it is hard to believe that school starts next week. It's the summer's gone by. So what's on the school menus this year? What's going on in our schools? Our guests have some news for us. Penny Parham is the Director of Food and Nutrition for the Miami-Dade County Schools. Welcome, Penny.
Hi, thank you. Welcome to you, too.
Nice to have you here, as usual. You're here every year with us. And Mary Mulder is Director of Food and Nutrition Services for the Broward Schools. Welcome, Mary Mulder.
Thank you, Linda. It's great to be back here for a fourth year.
Is it that,
that
time
long?
For this? Well, it's great having you both here. And we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. Do you have any questions, comments, or suggestions? Now's your time to talk about school lunches. Give us a call. That's 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN.
And email is radio@WLRN.org.
And, of course, we don't want to forget our favorite wine guy is with us. Fred Tasker. He's joining us by Skype, and he gives the wine suggestions for my Dinner Minutes column that you can read in the Miami Herald. And you can also read Fred's wine column. It's on Saturdays in the Miami Herald. Fred, what are we drinking today?
Well, you're talking about cafeteria food, so I think I'll talk about cafeteria wine.
I don't think
so. No, just kidding, just kidding.
Actually, the two of them here.
I'm going to talk about wine that the adults can be tasting after the kids are shuffled out the door to school.
Okay. You had two people here who turned white when you said that, Fred.
I bet they get some pretty good stuff, but we won't go into that.
Okay, fine. Well, let's start with Penny Parr and Miami-Dade County Schools. What's new this year?
Well, thanks, Linda. We have a lot of new things, and we're really excited about all our students coming back on Monday. And we have some new menu items that I brought some samples in, but we also have a new tray that we're calling it a new plate, that we're going to be serving our meals on. We are moving into a fiber, paper-based, compostable plate that is away from styrofoam.
I'm holding it up here. So this is not television, but I'm holding it up anyway. And it's compartmentalized. It's not polystyrofoam or anything like that.
And is it made from recycled paper?
It's made from, I think it's post-consumer, all paper. It's made in America. And the reason that we've worked very hard to try to find one that's affordable, and this is so that we can start moving away from using the styrofoam that has been consistently less expensive and used in many programs because of its very low cost.
It's sort of like the fan beard tray at the stadium.
Well, you know what?
The same material.
Right, or like if you've been to Chipotle, they have the bowl that they serve everything in. It's that fiber material. And we're going to be serving this. And we have all of our programs falling under a new brand that we've established called Lean and Green. So some new vegetarian choices, some new smoothies, new breakfast items, and our tray pilot, where we're branding everything under Lean and Green, providing education on sustainability and eating more healthy.
But we have the tray here, and it's fabulous. It's filled with all these wonderful foods. I've taken a photograph of it. It'll be on my Facebook page. And by the way, we've just had a video taken of the plate, so that's probably going to be on the WLRN page. And you'll be able to see it. Mary, tell us what's going on, Mary Mulder in Broward.
Great. Well, thank you so much again, Linda, for having me this year. Our most exciting initiative this year is something that we began piloting last spring, which is the Universal Free Breakfast. We're one of the larger districts that is moving towards this trend. And it's a program in which every child is offered the opportunity to have a complimentary breakfast free of charge every day of the school year, regardless of eligibility.
Every child. It doesn't matter.
Exactly. Every child.
And what is the breakfast?
The breakfast consists of either cereal, it could be scrambled eggs, it could be a piggle stick, which is a sausage rolled in a biscuit. It could be a yogurt parfait with fruit, yogurt, and granola. Then we also have our fresh fruit component, which could be honeydew, melon, the
and
cantaloupe.
And all this is available before
all available
school.
All before school starts.
What time do they have to get there? I'm coming.
Great. We'd love to see you. We'd love to see you. See what we're doing. It all depends on the school. Parents need to contact their school for the actual time that breakfast starts. It's normally a half hour before the actual school day begins. And we began this pilot last year. We saw a 10% increase in breakfast participation in that 2.5 month period. So we saw that it was something that was very receptive for the school community, receptive for the students. Our faculties, our administrations were wonderful, very flexible, very receptive with our cafeteria food and nutrition services managers.
So the parent could drop their child off early
exactly.
And leave them there and go off to work.
Exactly.
Exactly. Well, now, just want to say that, Penny, you have a special something going on with your breakfast program. You have a similar breakfast program.
Right. Well, Miami-Dade's had the Universal Breakfast Program, which really stands for breakfast free to all students in all schools. We've had it since 2003. We've had it for some time. So that's really great, Mary. And I know that this is something that has to be, worked through, and you really have to promote it. And one of the things that we're excited about, too, is on the first day of school this year, starting August 24th, for the 10 weeks through the week of November 2nd, students who eat a school breakfast every day of the week in their school in Miami-Dade County are going to be eligible to be randomly selected for a $50 Amazon gift card. We are going to have 30 student winners each one of those 10 weeks.
Wow.
So In other words, all you have to do is eat breakfast.
You have to eat school breakfast. You have to eat school. Thank you, Bonnie. You have to eat school breakfast each day of that week for your student ID number to be placed into the random selection.
Well, and both Mary Mulder and Penny Parham, you told me that this whole school program is paid for by the federal government. Is that right?
Correct. It's a federal reimbursement for the number of meals served. You are correct.
What is what department?
United States Department of Agriculture. USDA.
So, I mean, that is really fantastic that that's happening.
Right, and it's so important because a child who is not has not had proper nutrition can't focus.
Exactly.
They won't learn. They can't reach their achievement level. And we really strive as a support services department to ensure that the students have what they need to learn.
Now, I also understand that you've both been working with your cafeteria staff to be more aware of healthier foods. What's happening there? Mary, you have somebody come up this year?
Exactly. This past summer, we had someone come from FLDOA, which is the Florida Department of Ag, and they were training our high school managers, our high school cooks and assistant cooks, on roasting vegetables and taking what the USDA promotions are on fresh fruits and vegetables and actually tying it into our menu. So our students this year coming back will see roasted vegetables on the menu, Brussels sprouts, cauliflower, broccoli, items, a yellow squash, zucchini, items that they may have seen on the menu before, but not roasted.
Mm. And you know that the Florida Department of Agriculture is a great supporter of our programs. They do provide training opportunities. We do a summer training institute in Miami, and this summer we trained over 1,600 of our part-time and full-time food service personnel, and they were trained on the lean and green. They were trained on healthy preparations, also customer service and quality control. So it's great. And I think Mary and I both could say that our Florida Department of Agriculture is a great supporter of having training opportunities that they provide to the districts.
Well, I wanted to say, I'm sitting here with this big, beautiful tray of food, and I want to tell people what's on this tray. Well, first of all, there's what is this, lasagna?
I told Linda, this is a substantial full tray because it's samples of many different new things. We have a new vegetarian lasagna item that is part of our entrees, and that's an example of it.
And I'm going to hold this up for the video that's being
What I put on the tray was a lot of grapes, but that's a larger portion of grapes than would be one serving. But fresh fruit, that is a vegetarian wrap. That is and one of our lean and green items. We've been serving vegetarian choices for many, many years. But with the lean and green branding, we're going to be able to make it much more visible to the students. It's going to be visible on the menu if you look it up on the webpage. And it's also provided an umbrella branding to connect to our sustainability education.
And there's a guavalito here.
Oh, I have to talk about the guavalito.
It was delicious. So anyway, now the other program that you were both telling me about before we went on air was the supper program. I didn't know that you could have supper at school.
Yes, the after-school supper program, another program under the Department of Ag, and actually administered through the Florida Department of Agriculture, allows students to have dinner with us, have an after-school supper, if they're enrolled in an aftercare program in a school that is 50% or more free and reduced with the enrichment activities. And Broward this year has, again, increased the amount of programs that we have. We've gone from 51 to 64 programs. They are all programs that serve hot entrees. We'll have meatloaf, we'll have lasagna, we'll have baked chicken, and then the fruits, vegetables, and milk. And we're so excited about it. We have a wonderful collaborative effort with our after-school programs and with our department program that administers.
That's great.
We do the supper program as well, but we branded it called Snack Plus, and we do it more as a self-contained meal at the end of the after-school day.
Okay, well, that's very, very interesting. There are so many more things we want to talk about, but we're going to take a short break here. My guests are Penny Parham, and she's from the Miami-Dade County Schools, and Mary Mulder from Broward Schools. We're talking about back-to-school food. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. We'll take a short break, and we'll be back with more. And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we've been talking with Penny Parham. She's the Director of Food and Nutrition for the Miami-Dade County Schools, and Mary Mulder. She's the Director of Food and Nutrition Services for Broward Schools. And we've been talking about school lunches and breakfasts and suppers. A lot of fun things going on in school these days with the food systems there. But now it's dinner in minutes time. And here's one that's perfect for busy back-to-school evenings, or really for any time. And it's a smoked turkey and cheese panini with an Italian arugula salad. And you can make it in minutes, and you don't need a special panini press. All you need to do is put it in a skillet and press it hard with a lid, and then flip it over and press the other side, and it comes out fine. Now, I use ciabatta bread, and it's Italian bread that's shaped like a slipper. Ciabatta is the Italian word for slipper. But you can use anything, a large baguette, a Subway, or focaccia. You cut the bread in half. You drizzle the bottom half with a little olive oil. I have some sliced smoked turkey I put on the bottom half. I put some roasted red peppers that you can buy in a jar. And I sprinkle some goat cheese over that. And also some basil leaves. So you cover the top half, spray a skillet, and cook it 3 minutes. Turn it and cook 3 minutes. Sounds really good. Simple. The side dish, and Penny's saying, oh boy, that sounds good.
That's so good.
And for the side salad, you buy some Italian-style washed and ready-to-eat salad, a little arugula, an olive oil dressing, and you're done. It's Dinner in Minutes, and you can see the full recipe and a photo. It's at dinnerinminutes.com. And please follow me on Twitter. That's at L. Gassenheimer. Fred Tasker, we're not drinking in the school cafeterias, but what are we drinking?
Well, it's the hottest time of the year in South Florida. I look at the temperature down there and feel some pity for you folks. So how about we sit out in the patio this weekend and have some nice, powerful red wine? No?
No.
Fred.
Well, maybe not.
Don't worry, Fred. We'll get you when it's wintertime, okay? And it's snowing and storming up there.
Well, we still got to have our backyard barbecue, right? So here's the solution, sangria. It can be light, tasty, and low calorie and low alcohol, and it gives us, even wine snobs, an excuse to put ice cubes in their wine, which is a pretty good thing this time of year. Now, sangria was developed in temperature zones just like this, in the Valencia region of Spain, between Madrid and the Mediterranean. I drove that one time in a convertible and got the worst sunburn of my life.
Okay.
In the
was
old
that
days,
the wine or the sangria or the sun?
Well, that was the sun, but it's certainly around in South Florida.
Yep.
In the old days, the red wines of the Valencia region were pretty heavy and alcoholic and tannic, and the last thing you'd want to drink in the heat. So they looked around and decided to pick a few tasty Valencia oranges and maybe some lemons, and added some sugar, and sangria was invented. And of course, these days they would add soda water and pour it into a pitcher full of ice. Now, contrary to what you might hear, there's no such thing as an original or authentic sangria. So this is a democratic drink to be made any old way you like it. And every Spanish family swears its own recipe is the best, and I swear mine is.
Okay. So what's yours?
If you add lots of fruit and soda water, you have a low-calorie spritzer. If you use white wine, you have sangria blanca or white sangria. If you add sparkling wine, you have sparkling sangria. Or on the other hand, you can add some brandy and you have a potent portable. Now these days, people actually go crazy. They add gin, vodka, triple sec, rum. They use mint, cloves, cinnamon sticks. They drop in chunks of peaches, pitted cherries, pears, apples, strawberries, even simmered down cranberries. The sky's the limit. Oh, and don't use expensive wine in sangria. With all the adulteration it gets, all of the extra ingredients, you'll never perceive any subtle complexities that might be lurking in the wine. So sip sangria and stay cool, my friends.
Sounds good. Sounds good. Bonnie, did you have an email?
Yes. Laura says, so happy we're trying to use items that decompose. That's wonderful news. Goes on to say they have a great program in Broward where vegetables and fruits are seasonal. They'll carry them around and pass them out like cranberries or kiwi, and some of the fruits are things that a lot of the children in school would never have an opportunity to try or learn about. Also says, great job with that baked chicken.
Oh, great. If I can just comment on, sure, on the tastings, I think the caller or the emailer is referring to our tasting program, something that we implemented in all of our elementary schools. And once a month, we have a tasting program that we have a fruit or vegetable that's highlighted, and every student has an opportunity in the cafeteria to try it, to taste, to feel, to smell it.
Yeah.
And then we provide the nutritional education for the teachers through their email conferences. And it could be something like a crossword puzzle, some type of journal entries, a history on the product, so that the student is not only seeing the product in the cafeteria and tasting it, but it carries into the actual education part of the school day and is embedded in learning.
Is that the fresh fruit and vegetable grant, Mary, or is that in addition to those programs?
That's actually in addition to those programs. Great. We still have something called the fresh fruit vegetable grant that I think you schools have all that also.
And it's more organized with that, but I love to hear that. That's a great idea to have it in all the cafeterias for the kids to taste. That's good.
And what is this grant that you're talking about?
Well, the Fresh Fruit and Vegetable Grant is something that I know Broward has them. We have 33 schools on it, and we receive a grant fund through an application process, and schools have three times a week to the classroom. They receive a fruit or a vegetable, and it's something much different perhaps than what would be served in the cafeteria. So it's something where they can be exposed to other items like a dragon fruit or a passion fruit, and that is in the schools where they have the grant. But I love the idea of having it everywhere where kids can just taste anything and then have it part of a lesson.
And actually last year what happened is when we had our mini peppers on, we had such a positive response from the elementary school community that we actually put those on the menu. And that serving is item on the menu. So the more exposure that we can provide the students at a young age, the better it works out for them.
Now, are you bringing in fruits and vegetables from local farmers?
Yes.
How is that working?
Absolutely. Well, we definitely, and we've had farm-to-school connections for some time, and part of our Lean and Green branding is to highlight those even more so. We have, in fact, the first week of school in Miami, we're going to have our fresh corn. It comes straight out of, there's a Hatton Farms, not too far from here, and they pick the corn, and we're serving it 3 days later. In fact, the farmer himself was at our opening of school meeting preparing the corn for all the staff to see, so that's one example.
Right. And we're doing the same thing in Broward. We use the green beans, the farm to school green beans, fresh farm corn on the cob, the cobettes. So we're doing the same thing.
And I was talking about earlier about the food, that we've got this big tray full of food here, and Bonnie is eyeing this vegetarian wrap. She's going to come and get it.
I can't believe you divulge everything. I can't tell you anything anymore, Linda.
Well, you didn't have to tell me. Your eyes were on this. But I'm also looking at this something called Naked Juice. What is this at school?
Oh, those are great.
Well, Naked Juice is a brand. And in Miami-Dade, we're bringing in a smaller size. That's a 10-ounce bottle versus sometimes you'll see them, mostly they're 12 or 16 ounces.
Right.
And we are bringing it in as a branded smoothie, and that's basically what it is, under our Lean and Green, and it's going to be a part of the meal with the vegetarian wrap. We're doing this at our high schools and especially in our reimbursable vending machines where the cold meals are, and we have 57 of those machines in our high schools, and that combination of the Naked Juice smoothie and the vegetarian wrap is going to be a vegetarian choice for lunch out of our reimbursable meal machines.
It's interesting that you're having an emphasis on vegetarian this year. Yeah. Are there that many students who are interested in that kind of food?
Well, we've always offered it, but we haven't marketed it. And I think that it's just, one thing I always like to say is I don't want to promote Chipotle so much, but I do have teenagers, and they love it. And you know what? I like going with them because if I want to choose the whole family, someone might choose beef on their or with lots of vegetables. Within the selections, you can have a vegetarian lunch, or you could have one with meat or chicken. And that's how we want to make sure that our cafeterias are offering the variety.
And I see you have yogurt here, and it just looked like this wonderful tray of food. We might just abscond with it.
There's the veggie wrap.
Yeah. Okay.
Can I mention the guavalito?
Yeah, just quickly, because we only have a couple of minutes.
We'll be introducing that for Hispanic Heritage Month starting the week of September 15th. Made in Miami. We were looking for that Miami taste, and we're super excited because it has no trans fats, low sugar, and it's going to be part of our breakfast menu.
And the guava, and it's delicious because I already tasted it. Well, it's been really a tasty week. Penny Parham, thanks so much for stopping by.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
And Mary Mulder, thank you.
Right, thank you for having
Penny
me.
Penny from Miami-Dade, Mary from
Broward Schools, and I know you've been very, very busy this week with school opening next week, so good luck for the school year.
Thank you.
Okay, and Joe and Bonnie, great to be with you.
Thank you.
And Fred Tasker, great advice as always.
Always a pleasure.
Well, next week we're going to be talking about food forests in the schools. Food forests. I'm Linda Gastenheimer. Join me then.
And thanks for tuning in this hour. Our producer is Richard Ives. Technical direction given by online producer Paul Leary. If there's a program you'd like to hear again, it's easy to find them at our website, wlrn.org. And also, we have more information and links at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow at 1, it's the South Florida Arts Beat. Monday, we return with a program about teacher education and what's at the core of good teaching. Are inspirational teachers born or produced through learning and practice? We'll be with education writer Elizabeth Green, whose new book is called Building a Better Teacher. So Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, Linda Gastenheimer, and Fred Tasker. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.